Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club. I'm your host, Connor Norcott. And as always, I'm joined by these two wonderful fellas, Liam Jones and Luke Chandley. Liam, how are you, man?
I am very well, thank you very much. Got a day off today, just been chilling, watching movies, Christmas films. I rewatched Citizen Kane today, actually, just to kind of been reading up on, you know, I've been doing my homework, reading up on some of the characters from the film we are covering today. And yeah, just had a nice day doing absolutely nothing.
I love those days. I'm having one of those myself at the minute. I think I've drank like three coffees, but I'm not bouncing off the walls. It's just nice. It's more to just keep me warm because I'm too stingy to put the heating on. But Luke, how are you doing, mate?
Yeah, good. They've got not a lot to say, really. What's happened? Nothing, really. Been in work today. Having a bit of a nightmare with my new business. But we don't need to go into that because I've been into that a lot today.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically 6 out of 10. Yeah, 6 out of 10. Thanks. How are you?
Honestly, once again, 6 out of 10 days are enough. No, not everyone needs to have a 10 out of 10 day. And I'm having a very 6 out of 10 day today. But the 6 good parts of it, man, I've hoovered, I've mopped, I've done all my dishes, I've cut my toenails, I've shaved. I feel amazing.
Bro.
Hey, that's 5 things. There's one other thing, but I'm not going to share that with the audience. But I'm feeling really, really good. Honestly,
okay.
Maybe these coffees are kicking in a little bit, but I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, this, I don't know, like out of 10, right? I was doing like an e-consultation thing for like a doctor's appointment today. And it said, what's your pain out of 10? And I put 5. And then it said, call 111 and see someone immediately. And I'm like, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
And I was like, I put 5 in again. It was like, call 111 immediately. Like, so if you're 50%, like between 1 and 10, if you're a 5, that's an emergency apparently. So I was just like, I'm just going to put 4.
Imagine if you're an 8. Fucking hell.
I know. Like, what are they going to say? I don't know if like an ambulance just falls from the sky onto your house. Like, yeah. I don't know. It's just, yeah, that was some bizarre thing that happened today in terms of like ranking your pain. but we'll be doing some more ranking later, won't we? When we rank film. Nice little segue.
That was a nice little segue. Although you say a nice little segue, but that was for you if you were hosting. Unfortunately, it's my job.
Yeah,
I've got
sorry.
No idea here. But I think we'll just jump in with the opening question as we always do. I don't know if you boys have had a chance to look at the agenda, but this one just came to my mind and it might put some of both of you or one of you maybe on the spot. The question is, if you could have a film like Mank made, so a biopic about the making of a film, what film would you pick? For me, the obvious one that jumped out was I looked at all the Blu-rays in front of me and it has to be Apocalypse Now for me. I know Hearts of Darkness was made, which is like a documentary about the, you know, the production history behind that film. But I want to see the kind of overhyped crank to 11, not the truth, but you know, some of the kind of nonsense that happened behind the scenes. And I was trying to think of, while I was doing the agenda, who would you cast as like the main actors, I guess, and characters, and who plays Francis Ford Coppola, things like this, and who plays a young Dennis Hopper. Oh man, it would be so good. It would be like a whole podcast to itself as well, so we don't have to do this, but
I think you could almost go like Coppola again with The Godfather, because there's always something with Coppola, isn't there? There's always some kind of falling out with the actors that he wants to return, but they don't want to return. And, you know, some kind of, some contract that's gone, you know, tits up. You could just do like a series of, I swear I heard that they actually are doing a film about the making of The Godfather.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
I think they are, or a TV show or something. They are doing some version of, you know, a making of The Godfather. Other than that, I don't know, Connor. Go to Luke, see what he says, and then I'll tell you mine in a minute.
Go on.
So I thought this is absolutely a fucking amazing question, and I couldn't think any idea what I was going to choose. I really feel bad that I'm going to go to this one. I actually think this would make a good making of film. But I'm going to go as I always go with all the answers to the questions, probably Ghostbusters.
That would be
because
good.
I feel like Bill Murray is a bit of a tit. Like he's great, but he's known to be like a bit of a tit, I think, or a bit of an unusual character. And also, Dan Aykroyd is quite strange, and I think they went through many iterations of the story to get to Ghostbusters, but like loads of mad iterations. And also, Dan Aykroyd is a little bit of like a ghost believer type person and quite a paranormal person. And I feel like that would be absolutely mental to see on screen. And like you've got all these like famous actors, haven't you, who like you would see as so other cool. people. So maybe that. And I honestly think I could probably think of something better maybe, but like all that was coming to my head was like Jurassic Park.
I feel like any of like the late 70s, early 80s films, comedy films, because they were all like Nick DeSemlian, didn't he, wrote Wild and Crazy Guys about that time period. And yeah, like there was so much sex and drugs going on.
I think that's what it is. Like you've got something that's like either completely wild and mental and almost untamable, or like something that's like so legendary that like people are interested in, like,
yeah,
even if it's a little bit slower, like you say, like The Godfather, like, mate, you know, there is probably stories behind the scenes, but like that's going to be more about like it's going to be more exciting because of what it's about. Whereas like if you pick something like something from the 70s or 80s, like it's just like sex, drugs and rock and roll, isn't it, really? Like it's going to be really interesting. So yeah
but, Fez,
have you thought of one yet, Liam?
Other than just kind of, I just kind of bounced off of both what you both have said and kind of just, you know, gone off of your ideas. I can't actually think of my own idea. I'm trying to think of just even like a cop-out answer. I can't even think of, because I can't off the top of my head think of any other kind of real kind of convoluted and weird kind of stories to like a creation of a film.
I wonder whether would Anchorman be good, because it absolutely did not do well at the box office, and it's got loads of mad comedians in it, and it is fucking great. That would be pretty interesting, I think. Or like one of the Seth Rogen boys, like Superbad or something.
Oh, cool! I'd also like to see, if it's not comedy, I'd like to see something like, you know, The Abyss, Steven Spielberg's The Abyss. Like that was meant to be fucking mental shooting that film, and I heard there's
a
lot.
Is it not James Cameron?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. I have a page of Spielberg up in front of me. That would be really cool, I think. Something like that. Especially, you know what I like? I am about James Cameron. I don't like him, but that might make me like him if I got to see that film made.
Yeah. I would, to be honest, I would totally love to see a behind the scenes of Alien, just because, like, or Blade Runner. I don't, like, Ridley Scott is a genius. Well, was a genius, let's say. But I think maybe Blade Runner would be really interesting, because I know that there was casting kind of issues with that, as well as even another Harrison Ford, obviously Indiana Jones. There was issues with Indiana Jones for sure. I'd love to actually, you know what? I'd love to see a behind the scenes film about Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. That would be fucking brilliant.
You know what though? I would see that. And not only that, to go back to a conversation we didn't just have off air, we had in our group chat that no one has saw yet. I'd love a podcast on the whole idea of films about films that were fucking awful. Do you know what I mean? Because let's be real, that film is dreadful. But it would make me go to the cinemas.
The biopic would be better than the film, and that would be sick.
Yeah. It would be so funny, because it would just be Steven Spielberg going like, oh, I've got this really cool idea, and Harrison Ford is looking at him like, oh, what am I doing?
I'm coming back for this. This one.
what am I doing?
There's so many that you could like. So like, even like Star Wars would be great because it was low budget and it was massive. But I think all like the filmmakers when they made like their first film. So like Last House on the Left by Wes Craven is legit the second worst film I've ever seen in my lifetime, and it was super low budget.
I love this.
Really
episode.
Awful. But like I think like that'd be cool because. You get to see how they try and make it with like hardly any money and stuff. So
I'd be buying into that actually. I think we could actually do a whole episode on the films that we'd like to see. Either just remade or made films about. But enough of that for now. That was some good answers. I'm going to say good answers all around. Even you, Liam, you did pretty well there.
Thank you.
All right, cool. So we'll move on to Mank then, which, as you probably saw in the title of the episode, is the film that we're covering today. We've been kind of dying to watch this for a while. At least I know I have. And we got the dates. I want to say we got the dates wrong, but we're finally doing it now. It's finally here. I would say
Google got the dates wrong. I Googled Mank release date UK and it gave me the theatrical release. I obviously wouldn't, why would I be looking at the theatrical release when all the fucking cinemas are closed? So I just took it as gospel with what it said there was the Netflix release date. However, it's done now. We watched it. It's on in the background. It's there. It's real. So we're fine.
Yeah, this kind of coincides with an episode we did a couple of weeks ago on Citizen Kane, because if you don't know, Mank is all about Herman J. Mankiewicz, who, so the film kind of tells the story of Herman, who was an author, a social journalist, and most importantly for this film, a screenwriter. And it's all about his battle to finish the first draft of Citizen Kane while he recovers from a serious accident. And I love this film. We're first take. I'm going to come to you boys about your first takes, because I feel like I'm the most positive out of the both of you. We'll start with you, Liam. What did you think of this film?
You know what? The more I've thought about it and the more I've kind of read up about the characters and kind of probably just gained a bit more context into the actual film, I have kind of on reflection really, really like it way more than I did. I really enjoyed it first time round anyway, but there were definitely moments that I was a little bit like confused by, not really understanding who everyone was. I think that's hard. That's difficult. I think that's maybe what takes some people out of a film like this, in that, yeah, we watched Citizen Kane, but like I only watched it once, like 2 weeks ago. Like it's hard to remember kind of, and then you also have to even know some of like the big players in the game of Hollywood in this, you know, 1930s, 40s period, which I don't think I did really. I didn't really know about. I do now, roughly. I've done a bit of research today and I feel like I've gained a lot of insight, and it has, you know, on reflection, definitely boosted my enjoyment of this film. I think it is really kind of brilliant. I love like the aesthetic and I love the screenplay. I think it's brilliant. Why is it credited as Jack Fincher as the writer? What's
because
that?
Because it was a script that David Fincher's dad actually wrote before he passed away, and he wanted to make this film before or after he made The Game. Or maybe it was after he made Fight Club, and Hollywood were like, we're not making a black and white film with you, sorry. There's no market for that. And, you know, there is no cinemas open at the minute. There isn't really a market for that. But Netflix, yeah, Thankfully brought out to us. But it's quite a passion project, I think, for David Fincher, because it was a film that him and his dad worked on together.
That's really sweet. I didn't quite get that. I thought it was some kind of like alias for some reason.
A pen name or something.
Yeah, I don't know what I thought. But no, honestly, I think the writing is exemplary. I know that, you know, we can all kind of interpret it as we want, but it's so snappy and punchy, and it's almost like it's so entertaining. Like it's almost perfect in terms of the screenplay, I think. And I think that's probably down to obviously his interest in this subject. Now, obviously realizing that, you know, he wrote this with his dad. So like he kind of probably feels an obligation for it to be perfect.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's writing about characters or like real people who were really interesting people. And, you know, they did have all these conflicts and they were really charismatic. And I think like that's why it probably does jumps out of the screen a little bit more so than some other films, some other biopics, because these are really interesting people and their conversations they have with each other are interesting. And even the first time I watched it, without, you know, any real context, I still thoroughly enjoyed kind of that aspect of it, because it was kind of really entertaining to me. So yeah, all good. First take is very, very good.
Oh, nice. I really like that. On to yourself then, Luke, what did you make? Because I think you were you've watched it most recently out of all of us. I know we might all have it on in the background somewhere, but what about yourself?
I wasn't fussed about it either way, really. I don't. Really weirdly, I even thought this straight afterwards, I was kind of like, that happened.
And that was a film.
That was a film, and definitely not in like no moment was it like this is shit or I don't like this or I'm not enjoying it. But conversely, I also there wasn't loads where I was like, I proper love this. So I suppose in the way where you said like, yeah, that film was like oh, was fine, but I'd never watch it again. And I think that's probably how I feel.
Yeah.
Or like I'd watch it with someone else, and I wouldn't say no, but I just wouldn't like. I wasn't that fussed myself. I'd watched it a second time, because what Liam said about the screenplay and the actual writing of the film, I didn't. There was some dialogue that I enjoyed, so like the dialogue I thought was quite snappy, and especially you know I'm doing like a little bit of reading on Mankiewicz and how I think I read somewhere that a couple of people said he was like the funniest guy in Hollywood or New York or whichever one it was. And like I liked the fact that there was like a lot of back and forth, and it like Liam said, it was snappy. But I think I felt like the film was a little bit of a mess. And I know it goes back and forth between different periods for particular reasons. So I'm more inclined to think that I just personally wasn't into that than the film is actually a mess. So like when I say it's a mess, like I just slightly struggled with all that, but like I also presume that I could probably watch it again having kind of know what's coming and know the story and not think it was a mess. I definitely think that's personal preference more than anything else. But like in terms of stylistically, like I think like you say, me and Liam, like you loved it, and then me and Liam were like, oh yeah, we're not sure. And then obviously Liam's like thought a bit about it, watched Citizen Kane, had a little read and stuff, and you do like things change your perspective. The thing that me and Liam, even when we thought we didn't know how we felt, we both said like in terms of stylistically it was like gorgeous, and it is.
Yeah.
And like kind of it's black and white but with a definite like modern era. It's not got the grain to it of like an old film, so it's like it's definitely a mismatch in a good, like a, not in a mess way, in a good way. And I really would not be against seeing more films in black and white. I remember when was it the Artist? Is that what it's called? The Artist?
Yeah.
Came out with black and white. I remember thinking this was probably a few years ago that wasn't it? And I remember thinking, oh, that's wanky that. Why do you need a black and white movie?
Yeah.
I would absolutely not be averse to seeing more film. Yeah. If they were like filmed for black and white, not like
yeah,
a film, and then they just put it in black and white.
They just put the filter on it.
Sometimes
though, like I rewatched Parasite, and they released a black and white version of that in like 4K. But I read kind of what Bong Joon-ho said about kind of his actual, because he and his editing team did it themselves, that the transfer to black and white, it wasn't just like a click and it's done kind of thing like you would do on like your laptop. It was like a real thought process into the kind of graduation, whatever, you know. I'm not, you know what I mean, the color contrasts, whatever. And it's absolutely amazing. I think I kind of maybe even preferred it in black and white, because it maybe, I think it does lend itself to that kind of style as well, like films, film like that. But no, I agree with Luke as well. Another thing I agree with you, Luke, is that the time jumps are probably the worst thing about this film for me. They're not incredibly bad. There are a couple of times where they aren't explained properly, to the point where to the point where Mank didn't know Maya, and then they kind of like flick through a couple more scenes, and then next minute he's introducing Maya to his brother, And I don't know if there was, maybe I missed that there was an explanation of them meeting, or maybe you find out later. It's just kind of a little bit of confusion in the, maybe, I don't know. It's probably, he's obviously meant for it to be that way. I know, like, yeah, he's, you know, he's meticulous. It's not like a mistake, but I just think, you know, for me and maybe for Luke as well, there's just some bits that with the editing of the kind of time jumps, you know, back and forth and whatnot, it took me a little bit out of it. But not a lot, not a great deal. I think most of it does flow quite well.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Connor, then go on. What about your first take?
And I wholeheartedly, it's my film of the year. I fucking loved it because what a surprise.
Not Tenet.
maybe next year, who knows, if they re-release it, probably
black
not
black and white version of
Tenet. They actually fixed the signs in it, that might be interesting. No, genuinely, like, I've spoke to you guys off air. I had a bit of a rough week this week, last week, whenever we watched it, and it came out on the Friday just as I was kind of sorting my head out, and I was so excited to watch it. And I love David Fincher. I think he's such an interesting filmmaker. And I didn't know what the hell he was going to do, but I also love the whole discourse that revolved around Citizen Kane and the dispute of writing credits and whether Mank actually deserved one or it was all Orson Welles. There's been articles that have been published. And me and Liam spoke off air about the Pauline Kael article, which is kind of what birthed this film.
It's what That's a long essay. I read half of it.
It is a very long essay.
I feel quite bad that I just it was so late when I started reading it, and then it got to the point where I was like, you know, I can't get it. But I got
you
it
also
bad.
Know the you know the but gist did, of it. Yeah.
Yeah, but like just reading like the first half of it was insightful enough, to be fair. Mm-hmm.
Well, it kind of disputes that actually Orson Welles was a fraud, essentially, and he was a con artist, and it was all the work of the cinematographer Greg Toland and the writer Herman J. Mankiewicz, and these guys were the real reason Citizen Kane is as good as it was. Anyway, always been a fan of like film history and Hollywood, old Hollywood. And seeing
can we
all
talk,
of this.
Sorry
kind
to
of,
cut you off. Sorry.
No, please.
Can we make sure? Can we make sure that we talk about that in a bit? Because I really want to. I really think it's interesting, the whole Orson Welles versus Mankiewicz kind of thing. Just because, you know, he didn't. Orson Welles probably didn't have the career off the back of this as everyone would have expected, and maybe that's why, because he wasn't as involved as people actually thought he was.
Actually, it's an interesting thing, and it also that lends itself to kind of the big climactic square off that they have that doesn't really mean anything in terms of the film, because the film's already been made. It's all in the past now. I think the reason why this film resonates so well with people like myself who are obsessed with, well, is because people like me are obsessed with old Hollywood and old films like Citizen Kane. And it reminds me of in our first season, a couple of weeks in, we were all talking about what films we need to watch. And I said to you guys, look, it's one of my favorite films ever. Let's do Sunset Boulevard. This kind of feel like it's so much nostalgia and yearning for the beauty of cinema. But it also shows you how fucking corrupt and horrible Hollywood can be. And I think it dovetails those things really nicely. But what Mank does now is that it has this almost 2020 vision, pun definitely intended, where you can look at, you know, the state of the political spectrum in America now, and you can almost transpose the way the 1930s was and the influence of the media and cinema on politics. And that's a really interesting thread that kind of runs throughout this film that we'll probably talk on later. Because I think I've read in some reviews and watched in some other or listened to some other people's reviews, and they didn't really get that tangent of the or that narrative thread that kind of goes through the film with Upton Sinclair and stuff like that. For me, I love that because I'm a fan of all that stuff, but that can be lost on a lot of people. So long story short, awesome. I loved it. I'd give you my popcorns, but that'd spoil the podcast. Cool. So you boys have already talked about the aesthetics, which obviously we're gonna have to talk about because it's such a good looking film. What else kind of jumped out to you? Because for me, I watched it the first time, obviously, and it all just hit me at once, and it was this big, beautiful combination of everything. But I had it on in the background today when I was doing the agenda, and I almost wasn't watching it, but because of the score and the sound design, I was in it. I felt like I was in it again, and I was so into the film the first time that I almost knew where I was based on the sound design. I think the sound design is Oscar-worthy for me. But what stood out to you, boys?
I 100% agree with you with the sound design. It's so it just you know, it's almost exactly the same sounding to me anyway as the films did. You know, like when we watched Casablanca, it sounds so similar, and mm-hmm. when I rewatched Citizen Kane today, it sounds so similar. And I wonder, like, you know, what actually goes into them, like, now in 2020 making the sounds so, because it's not an obvious distinction, it's so subtle, but it's so obvious as well. And how do you go about that? Like, the technicality of it to me is what stood out as well, in that I just couldn't wrap my head around, you know, how they would even go about it. Obviously, these technicians are, you know, world class, the best in their game. So obviously, it's probably quite easy for them to just do something like that.
I hope it's not just like an effect on Premiere Pro or something.
Yeah.
They just slap on old timey effects and there you go.
Yeah, another thing I was really impressed with is the performances. I think we all know, obviously, Gary Oldman is an absolute legend. I think he's played a drunk person better, though, in the episode of Friends. I think you know what I'm on about when he's with Joey. I'm joking, by the way, but, you know, I just couldn't stop thinking of that. Like, that's like, I was like, where have I seen him play a drunk man before? And I was like, yes, Friends. Ross and Chandler's wedding, isn't it? Anyway. The performances, yeah, I think Gary Oldman's great. I think he does steal the show, but I think Amanda Seyfried is amazing, and I don't think people give her credit as an actor. Mm-hmm. She's really great. I think people just think, oh, it's the girl from Mamma Mia, but in fact, she's actually really brilliant. She just brings Marion Davis to life, and I didn't know what Marion Davis looked like, so I had a look on IMDb, and they don't look that alike, but they both have these, you know, the wide set eyes as well, wide set, wide eyed. And that as well, the casting, I can keep going on. Like, I was speaking in our chat earlier, and William Hurst and Charles Dance look so similar. It's creepy. So obviously it's like perfect casting.
The biggest casting similarity, and I just saw it before we hit record, was one of the studio executives, or he goes on to become a studio executive, but he's in the writer's room. I think his name's like Greg Tholland or something. I can't remember. Tholland. They look identical, and it's fucking, it's like, you know, those weird Twitter things you see, and it's like, this man is a time traveler, and someone's just superimposed David Bowie onto like the pyramids of Giza or something. It's some madness like that.
Yeah.
It blew my mind, man.
It's like how people go on about Margot Robbie and that girl from Sex Education and that other girl.
Yeah.
It's like this weird thing where everyone just seems to look alike if you're in Hollywood. I don't know. It's strange. But no, I don't think there's a bad performance in this film. I think Charles Dance's accent's a bit shaky, but, you know, I don't know when has he ever tried to do an American accent before. I can't recall it, him ever having to, and it's not that good. But he's still, you know, a very commanding figure. You know, he's playing one of the most powerful, you know, media conglomerate owners, you know, most influential. He's literally the person Citizen Kane is based on. You know, like, he does kind of convey this real kind of commanding, like authoritarianism kind of type personality, which I think is great. I think he's great. I think most of them are great. I really like Tuppence Middleton as well, who plays poor Sarah, just Sarah, as she would like to be called. She's brilliant. And as well, I was reading up on, because obviously she looks a lot younger than Mankiewicz, but I was reading in the essay me and Connor were talking about earlier, it describes Mankiewicz as just looking really old at quite a young age. He kind of had, probably due to his alcoholism, but his features just were heavy set in his 30s. That's why, you know, Gary Oldman is 60-odd, but he's playing like a man in his 40s. And I think that's, you know, that's done on purpose. It's not done just to shoehorn Gary Oldman in. It's done because Mankiewicz looked like an old man in his 40s. Not that Oldman looks like an old man. You know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
Luke, what did you take from this in terms of, you know, what stood out to you?
I'm really glad that we went from Connor to you to me, because I didn't want to just sound like I was agreeing with what Connor said. But the score and like the sound was... I've been like, so I can't remember if I said this on last week's podcast, and if I did, then I'm definitely repeating myself. But my little routine is listen to a bit of jazz before bed. I try and do that like every other night, or like every night or whatever, because I've got an Alexa in my room now. And I think I'm really getting into it, but like more slow, kind of ploppy.
Ploddy. Lounge room jazz.
Yeah, lounge room jazz. And and that's kind of what like the score reminded me of. And that's what I don't know whether that I'm listening to it because I like that. But it is like kind of just, you know, you have all these visions of what old Hollywood was like. And it, to me, it's, I'd love for just for a few days, just, you know, if I could time travel, if I could be that guy in one place, suddenly be that guy in Hollywood, I would go back. And so this, and it just sounded like, you know, it sounded like this was a film that was made in like 1930.
Sounds authentic, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't sound like a film trying to sound like this. Like they just did it, and it worked brilliantly. And like the performances, yeah, I thought they didn't stand out for me. I didn't think they were bad. I just mean like I watched it and they didn't stand out. And I'm sure if I watched it again, some would stand out. Yeah, I mean, Gary Oldman's just great, isn't he? And
he is, but
he's just good. He's just a good actor.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he's just a good actor. Like, this isn't a apex of his game performance. This isn't, or he's not doing some mad thing like he did in True Romance where he plays a pimp. Like, not like that. But it might be annoying. It's almost rude because he's so good. He's so naturally good that it's almost dismissive. Like, he's doing a ridiculous accent. It's almost transatlantic where it's half English, half American. But it works so well. And also, like, I don't know about you, but because I knew who Mankiewicz was and I kind of cared about this discourse anyway, I cared about him. Like, in the film, I cared about him as a character. And I don't think the film does anything to really make you deserve that or make it deserve, you know, your attention or your care. But most of it kind of relies on Oldman as a performer. And because he's so genuine, you almost don't acknowledge it. Like, it's not standout. He's not doing Churchill with prosthetics. He's just Oldman in a suit, in a bed. Like,
there's, and it works. There's some filmmaker who's, I can't think of his name, but he's got a bit of an ongoing feud with David Fincher at the minute. And he's a well-known filmmaker. And for me, not, it's going to, anyway, I'm going to explain it anyway. Mm-hmm. He wrote about Mankiewicz, about the actual character, saying that it's like rule 101 of filmmaking is don't make a film about people no one cares about because you will immediately just switch off. But the thing is, you've got Gary Oldman, like, that's why casting is clever, because you cast someone who, you know, we all love, you know, we all respect, we all know is a good actor. So then that's like, you know, a plus. And then you kind of introduce him dead early and he's charismatic. So then you're kind of intrigued by him. That's within like the first 5 minutes. You've got Gary Oldman playing a charismatic person. I think, like, since when do you have to know the person to be interested or intrigued by them? I think it's just a really bad take.
Also, though, you find this, and we'll get on to the main agenda, but I've written this down in my notes, is when you watch biopics, it's pronounced biopic, not biopic, isn't it? Just need to mention.
It's biopic, yeah.
Yeah, when you watch a biopic, right? Most of those films, whether it's something like Catch Me If You Can or even the dreadful ones like Bohemian Rhapsody, they give you reasons, like emotional fuel, to give a fuck about the characters if you don't know them. Everyone knows Freddie Mercury. No, not a lot of people know the person, I can't remember, Frank, that Catch Me If You Can is based off. But most people, you have to either earn, as a character or as a writer, you have to earn the audience's respect for characters. And I don't think Fincher does that. And I think that's why a lot of people switch off for this film, or a lot of people don't love it as much. But if you are watching it because of Oldman and not Fincher, or when you're actually watching the film, you're focusing on Oldman, it can become, you know, you can kind of buy into it without having to care that much. But they do give you reason later on, you know, kind of pathos and reason that for Mankiewicz to make these decisions, to make this film, to go against the people that he was almost friends with, to make Citizen Kane. And
yeah,
for me, if you make it that far and you're still kind of you know, you're still kind of on the fence, then is it a really, really a good film? That's up for other people to decide. But for me, it works.
I think it's, just to make a comparison to Citizen Kane, I think Mankiewicz in Mank is a far more likable character than Citizen Kane in Citizen Kane.
Far more likable character than...
I think Gary Oldman's Mankiewicz in Mank is a far more likable character than Kane is, than George Wells is Citizen Kane. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. The person that he's compared to in Kane, you mean?
The two leads, basically. Yeah.
The two leads. I don't know if I feel like I actually explained that fine. I don't know if Connor. I got it.
I put my heating on. I'm so hot and I can't take my jumper off while podcasting and it's all stressful.
I really just like to kind of maybe go a little bit against what you're saying. I really, really, I kind of like empathize and sympathize with Alderman's portrayal of Mankiewicz in this. I don't know. And I know it's like, oh, he's just a drunk writer. I know you said that, Connor. I don't know if it was off air you said, because it is a typical, it's stereotypical. And, you know, it's been done before. Yeah. But he was an alcoholic writer.
Yeah,
it's not done for effect. Well, it is done for effect. But it's truth.
Yeah.
And I've just felt really sorry for him at times. I think it's difficult, isn't it, when someone is being a bastard. Like, you've got his wife who is so lovely and she's there for him all the time and he just keeps shitting on her and disrespecting her and cheating on her. And I wrote down, because there was one scene which is like really kind of good but really bad at the same time, and it's when it's Maya's birthday. What's his first name?
Louis
B. Mayer's birthday, and Mank is kind of like sitting almost like right in front of his wife who sat next to him and just keeps like having these back and forths across the room with Marion Davies, who is like obviously sat close to her fella who is Hurst, and it's just awkward. It's made me cringe because he just kept everything she said he would like go, yeah, right back at you. Like,
that's really bad because they're my favorite scenes and I didn't feel bad or guilty.
I don't know, but then that's what it made me cringe a bit.
But I know what you're saying, though. I understand the empathy.
But the cringe doesn't come from like it. Like, if I was in that room, I would have cringed. Not that like the scene is cringy bad.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it portrays to me cringiness. But then next, that like some of the other dialogue in that scene is so good when Mankiewicz says, talking about communism and socialism. So socialism is distributing the wealth. Mm-hmm. Communism is distributing the poor. No, whatever. You know what I mean. I think we know this word.
Distributing
in socialism, everyone shares the wealth. In communism, everyone shares the poverty. Mm-hmm. There we go. I wrote it down so I wouldn't fuck it up, and I fucked it up anyway.
That was a scene that we all talked about in the group chat, wasn't it? Everyone really raved about that.
And you've got like Louis Mayer as well in that same scene when they're talking about Hitler, and he says, you don't turn your back on a market as big as Germany. And it's just so, and they're all doing impersonations of Hitler and they're like, ah, Hitler Schmittler. It's like, and it's really interesting, that scene. I didn't
think he was that much of a bastard, and I actually thought he was quite likable. Other than the odd little bit and bob. And I'm wondering whether, like, I've got the film on here now, which is a thing we do now, and I fucking love it because I find it hard to remember things sometimes. But he's just, I kind of dispute a few things there, and I don't know who said them or anything, but I think he is likable because he's always on the outside, always. He's like, even when they were just at the party then, not the one where he's very drunk, the one towards the beginning where they're discussing the Germany situation.
Yeah.
And he's sat with his wife, not in the main group, but still part of the party. And he's flinging things back and forth. And obviously there's the real like capitalist pig dogs who are like Mayor from Metro Golden Mayor and Hearst as well, and they're talking about Hitler and Germany and stuff. And is he just not that much of a bastard because there's bigger bastards in the film?
Maybe
it's like because I mean, really, like, and don't get me wrong, I don't think he was a bastard, but I also think that there's just bigger, Mayor is that I think you spoke about the scene, Connor. Oh, no, maybe it was yourself, Liam, where he's walking through and he's given the three rules It's brilliant. Three Rules of Hollywood or Three Rules of MGM. Uh-huh. And the first one is it doesn't stand for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. I can't remember what he says it does stand for. And then he goes off and asks them to take a 50% pay cut.
That seems incredible.
Like, yeah, it is. And it was on just then.
It's like when he like touches his eyes to start crying, like,
I missed that the first time and I saw it the second time. Just goes,
very hand cocky, and you would say maybe.
But I just generally think that maybe like there are bigger bastards, and even Orson Welles, when they just, you know, we'll probably come on to it a little bit later, but when they actually have a one to one that you see on the screen as opposed to a phone call, like he is a bit of a bastard as well, and you know, he stood up. Mankiewicz has sat down, he's frail, he's not even old, but you know, he looks old. And I just kind of think that there's lots more, whatever he is and whatever you may possibly think of him, there's more of that going on elsewhere to catch your attention, that actually he almost is like the underdog a bit.
I think what's really interesting about the portrayal of Orson Welles in this, and it's related to the score, is that when he appears on screen, not so much in their phone calls they have. I think there's one phone call where it actually cuts to him on the other end of the phone. But when he's actually in the same scene, in the same room with Mankiewicz, the score becomes almost villainous. And it's really interesting that that Fincher took that take. I don't know if maybe it comes from maybe Mank's point of view, that he sees Welles as the villain to his kind of, you know, creativity. Or is it David Fincher who sees Welles as the villain because, you know, he views him as maybe like the young guy who's like taking credit for things that he isn't even doing? Like that, what the whole scene, it's like the culmination of when he's finished his script, and, you know, Orson Welles wants full credit for something that he's been writing. And he's like, I've given you, you know, I've secluded you in this little house. I've taken all the alcohol away and stuff like that. I've taken you away from your disruptive friends. You give me this script. And Mankiewicz just wants, he's like, I've decided I just want, you know, it's my best work. I just want sole credit. And I think Welles does actually come across as a villain in this slightly, which I think might be down to that kind of deep lying kind of score that comes when he appears on screen. It's a bit like a low key kind of like drone, kind of makes you think, ooh, he's a bit scary.
He's a bit bad, him.
The voice by Tom Burke, is it, that plays Orson Welles? The voice is so good. It's almost perfect. When he's talking slowly and kind of calmly, the voice is spot on. When he gets a bit angry, it's a bit off. And he doesn't look anything like him at all. So much so that me and Connor were saying, before you joined, Luke, that it, like, they shouldn't have shown his face at all. They just shouldn't have showed his face because it looks nothing like him. It's a bit silly, really. So
that's why they gave him the beard. They gave him a beard just to cover up some of his face.
I know that, like, maybe, you know, he did embody him, and I suppose that's what acting is. You know, you don't have to have the physical features, but fuck me, he looked nothing like him at all. But he got the voice spot on, so that's, you know, bonus marks for that, obviously.
Okay.
I just wanted to talk about that.
No, that's fine. I want to come to this bit a little bit early on, and then we'll actually talk about the final, you know, the plot and how the film actually progresses. But do you have scenes or moments that stood out for you? Because there's one that stands out for me, but I'll talk about it right at the end because it's one of the end pieces of the film. But one of the scenes I love so much, and I just wanted to shoehorn it in here in case we didn't talk about it, is the first time, not Mank's brother Joe comes in, but maybe this like understudy to Mank you see in a flashback comes into this writer's room, and that they're called into the office of David O. Selznick, this legendary Hollywood producer. They're called into his office to pitch a film that they've meant to be working on for 6 weeks. And they all come in, they have the cigars, they have the drink, and they all sit on this elaborate, beautiful office. They all sit down and just ramble off this bullshit pitch that they had no fucking intention of ever talking about, because in their office they're actually just gambling. That scene is so funny, and the writing is so good, and it kind of takes me by surprise because I love Fincher when he works with really good writers like Aaron Sorkin in The Social Network. Like that That's a 10 out of 10 film. Nothing is wrong in that film. But the dialogue in this is so good. And it's almost like he's learned from Sorkin. And even with Gone Girl, I know that was an adaptation, but the dialogue in that's amazing.
Do you not think the dialogue's a bit Scorsesean?
I do a little bit, but I also
think... In terms of the punchiness.
Well, I think that's more Sorkin, because Sorkin is so the dialogue's quick and it's almost rhythmic. Like, you have to keep up. And if you keep
it reminded me of times, like, why I thought of Scorsese is Wolf of Wall Street, you know, when they're kind of like shooting the shit, you know, in their offices and stuff, and how it's all real snappy, punchy, like kind of bouncing off each other. Yeah. That's kind of what I thought of, you know, in some of them scenes, you know, like the one in particular you're talking about as well.
I love it because you have this kind of, whether he is an understudy or this, you know, this rookie comes into the office and they're going around in circles and they're almost like nodding to each other as they pass the script on or the pitch on. And it comes to this new guy and he gives this pitch about, I don't know, some robot or some machine that's created by a servant, and he gets frozen in ice. And that's meant to symbolize like and they have this line and it's like, well, it's got everything. It's got religion, it's got sex, it's got robots. And you see David O. Selznick look at him and his assistant goes, yeah, it's a B movie. But that was it. That's all they did, was they just kind of shot the shit and they did nothing really. And once again, it's Fincher showing that he loves cinema, but Hollywood just, I think it grinds him down a little bit. There was a great video essay I've watched yesterday on David Fincher and all of his films and how he's a control freak. And it's all of his films are about control in some way or another. And it stems from Alien 3, where the kind of bureaucracy of Hollywood kind of cramped him down and ended up ruining his inspiration and his vision for that film. And you kind of see it in Mank as well, because this film is all about authorship in the end of it. And that's what comes to the final confrontation almost. What about you guys? Did you have any scenes in particular that jumped out to you, or moments or performances or?
In terms of moments, it's more of like a 10-minute segment when Marion Davis and his brother come separately to try and convince him to not release the script for Citizen Kane. I like the scene that he has with Marion Davis. I think it's quite sweet because it's more of like a real mutual respect, because, you know, prior to that, he'd really embarrassed her and embarrassed himself when he stumbled in drunk to like one of Hearst's big kind of dinner parties at his big fucking castle, which is so brilliantly and clearly like mirrored in Citizen Kane, by the way. When I
rewatched Xanadu,
he's got these Xanadu. Yeah. He's got the fucking zoo and all sorts in it as well in Citizen Kane. But yeah, I like that kind of conversation they had. But I really like the one with his brother, because, you know, his brother is pissed off, but they still have that banter and they still have that mutual respect, and it's real sweet. You know, I don't know if, you know, going back to the conversation he has with Marion Davis, is it meant to be implied that maybe he kind of was in love with her a little bit, or had some affection, or was it more of like he saw her as a little sister? Because you don't see him ever like trying to think with her, but he's always there for her. You know, the moment where she Lou Myers' birthday, when she says something that's a little bit out of line and she takes herself out of the room, and he follows her and kind of comforts her. And I don't know if maybe he sees herself as a brother rather than a lover. What do you got? What's your take on that? What did you get from that, Connor, in terms of their relationship? I couldn't quite work it out.
There is a line in the film when Rita, played by Lily Collins, Rita Alexander, who's like the scribe, as you called it, Liam, she kind of types up his dictations of the film, the script as he sees.
Yeah, I know the line, yeah.
And she says, what was Marion like? And he's like, or no, did you know Marion? And I think he says like, well, if anyone did.
Yeah.
And I think you can read that in many ways. I don't know anything, any history between them two, but you see Mank, because he cares about people that he cares about, he's there for in his way. Like you see it with, oh my God, I can't remember his name now, his friend who becomes like the filmmaker behind the propaganda films in these. That scene is also really, really heart-wrenching as well. I think that's the scene that earns the, for me, it earns people's attention. It just comes a little bit late, but it has to for story purposes. I don't know what happened between them two, but I do find their interactions, specifically Marion and Mank, probably the most enjoyable in the film.
Yeah, yeah. That's that. Yeah, Amanda Seyfried's really kind of, she's great in this, which I said earlier, but yeah, going back to kind of when they're trying to convince him out of the script, I said that I might have preferred the conversation I had with his brother, but they are both great, because I never would have thought that, obviously they're thinking about his best interest, because, well, Marion's maybe a little bit selfish because she doesn't want her husband to be dragged through the dirt, because although Mank is denying it, you know, it is about Hurst and it is probably about Marion as well. But the conversation he has with his brother, it's more comes from, you know, kind of a place of love. He doesn't want his brother to kind of throw his career down the drain by releasing something that could possibly, you know, get him in trouble. I don't know. I just thought it was quite sweet, but
the brother scene is amazing for me.
Yeah, I think
it's the it's the one that kind of causes him to actually want credit, because it takes his brother to say, on his last words to him are, "It's the best thing you've ever written."
Yeah,
and I think that's when he's like, "Oh, all right, okay, we've got something here," and that's when that fuels the discourse around the writing credit in the film. I want to ask yourself, look, is there any moments, I know the film didn't click with you massively, but was there anything in particular that you took away from it that wasn't, I don't know whether it wasn't dialogue or sound design, but certain moments or scenes or?
I liked the scene where the scribe, I can't remember her name because I've got something else up in front of me.
Rita Alexander.
Yeah, he's given, I think you may have mentioned this earlier, he's given her resignation in. That bit's good. And then there's a story about how he is actually a good guy.
I forgot all about that. That's a really good scene. Yeah. And that's true as well. Apparently.
He literally saved, he saved a village.
Yeah, a village of people from Nazi Germany, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And I like that, just because, like, that's the bit. There's a couple of bits where you're like, she says he's a good guy or he's a great guy, and if he wants to drink and be treated like an adult man, then I'm certainly going to do that, which is a really good argument, I suppose. And so I like that scene, but there's a couple of scenes, isn't there, where you kind of think, like, I don't know, especially the socialism and communism bit that Liam recited earlier, and obviously all kind of, and then all of the capitalists who are kind of just, they're not bothered. They just want to, you know, they just want markets and selling money, and it's actually selling product, and where, you know, who will watch the films, and that's all they're asked about. And especially some of the looks that he gives them in that scene where he's, you know, he's clearly like not impressed by that type of thing, and that, so those two scenes for me just make you think there's something more, a bit more here to this character.
I agree.
And to this story in general, so I'd kind of say, I think I kind of say them scenes because they give you a greater idea of, you know, you got a character who's fleshed out a little bit more than just like you say, you know, he was just he was a writer who drank quite a lot, and that is very cliche, but then you've also got a little bit behind the scenes as well, a little bit really.
So, I love those kind of heavily politicized scenes, because, well, I don't know, one of my favorite ones is the election night when it becomes to Frank Miriam and against Upton Sinclair, and it's the, you know, Liberals against Democrats, and I don't know, I keep reading this weird parallel that you could maybe argue that I think Mank sees a little bit of himself in Hurst. When Mank gives this speech about He has this great idea for a film, Louis, at Hearst's birthday, the night he comes in hammered and reels off this pitch, essentially, that once again is improvised. But you can tell, you know, there's some truth in there. There's some at least soul-searching that's went on in there. And he compares it to the Don Quixote story about a guy who is eventually, you know, meets his match by someone who he kind of grows to realize is quite similar to him, but just an upstart version of him who's grown to, you know, evolve out of. That becomes the William Randolph Hearst and Upton Sinclair paradigm. But I think you see Mank in the middle of that think like, well, Mank is clearly a quite a liberal left-leaning fella. He's a socialist, as he calls himself. But he's hanging around with these capitalist elites who run Hollywood. And I just don't think that sits right with him. And you see his exposure to this and the kind of the harm it causes, not just personally for his friends, Shelley, I can't remember his second name now, but the director who goes on to kill himself because he made the propaganda films. But you also see, you know, it has a wider effect because once again, you know, the capitalist Republicans win the election in California and go on to, once again, Hollywood fuels that. And I think that kind of, I don't know, that kind of signals the, once again, like the brother scene that you talked about, Liam, that signals Mike's reasoning for, we're going after this fucker, essentially. But it's not just a hit piece. It becomes kind of self-reflectory about the state he was in. And it, you can, that's what, once again, why Citizen Kane is such a good film, that you can read it in so many ways, but you can also read a character like Herman Mankiewicz in so many ways through this film, which is once again a testament to David Fincher. Because, man, I don't know. I feel like he doesn't get talked enough about as one of the great modern day filmmakers, but he's been on a good role recently, and I'm all here for this. I just hope it doesn't take him another 5 or 6 years to make another film.
Hey, here's an interesting question then about Citizen Kane.
Go on.
Do you think that Citizen Kane is maybe a combination of both Hearst and Mankiewicz himself? Because obviously there are moments in Citizen Kane where he does care, and there are moments where he is really kind of emotional and is quite desperate, you know, for almost love. But I know that he, with his second wife, he's almost begging her not to go near the end.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like this kind of almost patheticness that I don't know, maybe Mankiewicz saw in himself when he was writing this, you know, as like an alcoholic. I don't know. I just click it because it's, although it's based on Hearst, it clearly isn't, you know, him, like everything about him. Yeah, it's aspects of him. And I don't know if maybe some of the other aspects has probably come from himself when he's wrote Kane, or maybe even Wells, you know, with his conversations he's had. And, you know, in terms of how ambitious Wells is at such a young age, you know, and maybe that was projected into like Citizen Kane's character. I don't know. It's just interesting, isn't it, to know kind of where his actual inspiration came from. Obviously, we know that it's Hearst to the bare bones, but, you know, when you flesh it out, is there some of himself being projected onto it?
I'd say so. There's that opening, one of the opening lines that is said to Mank is, what is it that writer says, write what you know? And Mike says, I don't know that writer. But you kind of see him rediscover himself and realize what he actually stands for. So maybe he is, like you talked about, maybe there is some of Herman J. Mankiewicz in Charles Foster Kane, which is a really, really, oh man, I'd like to, that'd be a very good video essay if anyone out there is listening and wants to do it.
Yeah.
I can't be fucked. But that's a good one. I really like that. So any other business, boys? Anything else you want to talk about?
I can't think of anything.
No, not really. I've had it on in the background, as I said before. And I don't know. I think when we talk about a film, it's always it does make you wanna, like, there's been films I haven't enjoyed and we spoke about it, and in a weird way I've been like, God, I kind of want to.
It's pretty good
it.
That. Yeah, yeah, but yeah.
And I'm just, I don't know, hearing you what you guys think of it and have it on the background, I do kind of want to watch it again, and I do, you know, maybe I think I probably would like it a little bit more. And I just kind of want, I basically just wanted to reiterate again that I just, it's such like a, It's such a gorgeous movie, and you know what? Part of it is obviously it's the lighting, but I honestly just think when there's like loads of smoke and you're in like rooms full of smokers and the light is reflecting off it, honest to God, that looks cool as fuck. And that's like, I know that's not a big tidbit, but like you see this, I might imagine especially a lot of older movies, because like I imagine you, like if this is this, it's just changed scene and he's got a cigarette in his mouth again. Like, you know, I imagine that it was just all
1930s in a nutshell.
Smoking looks so fucking cool in black and white films. It's not cool though. Don't smoke, not, folks. It's but it's so it looks so cool in black and white films.
And I just think that you wouldn't see the same effect if it was a colour movie. And I just kind of think like, It's so almost colour, but in a really good way.
I know what you mean.
There's a million different shades of black and white and grey, and it pops in the weirdest way. And I just think it's gorgeous. And God, give us more intentionally black and white films.
I agree. If anyone is listening and wants to watch some black and white films, this is a weird tangent. I recently just rewatched Cold War, an Oscar winning maybe, I think, film. By Pavel Pavlikovsky, a Polish film. It is fucking incredible. And you're talking about, look, films that make you almost want to start smoking. It looks that cool. There's a scene in a bar in there. Everyone's smoking. They're dancing to rock and roll. And it's in Paris. And oh, if I could go anywhere in a film ever, I'd be in that. But that was the coolest thing ever. Anyway, there is one little thing I want to touch on just before we wrap up then. And it's my moment of the film and probably moment of the year, as this is my, I think, I don't know, it's been a long fucking year. There probably is other films I enjoyed this year, but recency bias has kicked in.
Like Tenet, moment of Connor.
The year. Like Tenet, top, never mind. And it comes to, you know, you see after the conflict that happens between Orson Welles and Herman Mankiewicz, it comes to the Oscar night and neither of them go to the Oscar night to win the or to take their awards. Citizen Kane's nominated for 8 awards. And the only award that it wins is the best original screenplay or whatever it was called back then. Neither of them are there to accept it. But it does this so fucking beautiful thing. And I think it alludes a little bit, like you touched on, Liam, earlier, to how David Fincher feels about this. That you see, you know, that or you hear, and the Oscar goes to Citizen Kane for, and they call the names out. And they say Herman J. Mankiewicz, everyone starts clapping, and you can almost not hear Orson Welles, his name being called out, because they split credits in the film. And I think that alludes a little bit to, I don't know, maybe Fincher believes it was more of a Mankiewicz production than it was a Orson Welles written film. I love that. And then you get both of their separate Oscar speeches, and you see that there is actually kind of some love for each other there. In a very weird, strenuous way. And I just love that. Yeah. And that's what ends. And it reignites the debate again. It's why we're having it. It's why if you watch any other podcast or listen to any podcast, read any more reviews on this film, you're getting smacked in the face by the discourse around who actually wrote Citizen Kane and the Pauline Kael articles being talked about for the first time in fucking 70 years or whatever it is. Man, I love this
1971
film.
That essay came out.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. Anyway. I want to know your popcorns, boys. What are you saying? I'm going to come to you first, Luke.
Popcorns. I am going to... You know, last night I thought to myself, I was having that thought about, like, you know, it's okay for a film to be, like, fine, and that's... Yeah. It's a good... Like, that's, you know, it's arguably a good thing. And then I was like, 5 out of 10, that's fine, isn't it? That's average. And then I was... And I'm kind of thinking, like, it is, but it feels a little unfair. Really?
5 out of 10 is worth going to the hospital for. We established that earlier.
Oh, yeah, exactly. We did. Yeah, we did. Exactly. For context, if the listener fills out a questionnaire online about a particular health issue, that sounds like I know the health issue. I don't. just any health issue. If pain. You put over 5, yeah. If you put 5 out of 10 in terms hospital. Of pain and anguish, then you're being told to emergency get to hospital. So, so I think Mank should get to the Aussie. No, I'm gonna go like I'm just gonna go like 62.
That's cool.
62.
Yeah, it's interesting. If my popcorns was an NHS rating out of 10, I would be going straight to the hospital because I'm giving it 80 popcorns.
Science. Well, I think that's perfect.
Yeah, fully deserved, I think, 80 popcorns. It was probably about 5 popcorns lower before I started reading up on stuff today. But nonetheless, 80 popcorns. Fantastic.
I haven't changed my mind at all on it. I've watched it 1.5 times now because we started the podcast halfway through my rewatch. But I just think it's like... It's not a flawless film, but I want to say it is because I love it so much. For me, if you're going to the hospital straight away, Liam, I'm going to the morgue. It gets a solid 90 for me. Man, honestly, I could talk about this film all the time. And if you see me somewhere in Liverpool, please talk to me about Mank because it's all I want to talk about at the minute. Anyway, moving on. We've covered Mike finally. We can get past Citizen Kane and look forward to Christmas time. Yay. It's almost Christmas. You boys love a Christmas film. I don't absolutely as much. But this year, you're winning me rounds. I'm getting into them because next week we're having a little Christmas special, aren't we? We're going to be covering Home Alone and Luke's favorite film of all time, if you ask him on a Wednesday or a day that, day that ends in Y. Love Actually as well. I actually really can't wait for this, man. I love Love Actually.
It's gorgeous. It is. It's in my top favorites. It's I don't know if I call it my favorite Christmas film, which shocked someone the other day. National Lampoon's is up there, but like that's got history on its side. Love Actually is a very good second.
This is our first ever first take episode where none of us are doing first takes, right? This is just flat out Christmas specials.
It's just a hot take.
Because it's just hot take. We just want to be Christmassy. Is this where Connor's going to turn around and say, I haven't actually seen Home Alone? Because I know you've not seen Home Alone 2.
I've never seen Home Alone 2. I have saw Home Alone, but it was years ago. Maybe two years ago.
A refresh take for you then.
Yeah. Look, I'm looking forward to it. We're going to call it a Christmas special because we're going to get in the mood for Christmas. And hopefully by December the fucking 18th, I actually am in the mood for Christmas because not a mince pie in sight over here.
If we were going to be doing Christmas first takes, I couldn't now think of anything that I have not seen unless it was something awful, which I just didn't want to do. That's why I suggested we do, a couple of bangers that we just love because Christmas is meant to be about happiness, not watching shit films. Although, if your opinion is your opinion, my favorite Christmas film is The Polar Express, which I know a lot of people hate because of the creepy animation. I frankly love it because I think it's magical and Tom Hanks is the absolute boy. Next week's going to be fun, isn't it?
I'm looking forward to it, boys. I'm looking forward to it. But that's where we're going to leave you for this week. Thanks very much for letting me talk about Mike for an hour and a half or whatever it's been, boys. That's been lovely. Thank you very much. And until next week, I'll see you later.